Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the French Connection. Today's installment, Thursday, the 16th of February, 2006. Great to have you here with me today. We are continuing our series of educational interviews. As you know, the French Connection concentrates on the facts as best as we can divine them. And in the series with Mohamed Rafik, as well as Christopher and many others that we've had over the months, this particular gentleman we're going to have today is someone who has probably spent more time than all of the other researchers combined on the subjects of Zionism and how certain elements within the Jewish community have been able to co-opt power away from, I guess the sovereigns, us, the citizens of the United States and Britain for that matter. His name is David Pidcock. He's an author, a researcher, and a historian, and a fighter for the truth. And today's interview is going to concentrate specifically on finance. However, it is also true that David can speak on other subjects, and we hope to invite him back when that time comes as well. Today's interview will last about 40 minutes or so, and hopefully it will inform you as to how this is all worked out and how the finances in the world are working today. David, are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you. Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, David. You know, I want to first of all give everybody an opportunity to know the books you've authored over time. There are some important works that you've been able to put together on this particular subject and many others. You want to give the listeners the name of those books?
It sounds very pretentious to say authored. I mean, I've compiled a lot of material, and I've reissued a number of important books. As you're in France, it's probably interesting that we should probably begin with Napoleon and Islam, which is an extremely valuable work that was published originally in 1914. This covers, of course, the hidden history, because remember, the victors write the history.
That's
so
right.
The history of Napoleon is one that is extremely biased, but this book is actually, it actually contains all his official archive material, which covers his conversion to Islam and why he abolished interest. I mean, the issue of money, of course, throughout history is one of the most, it's probably the most important issue from Plato to NATO. But Napoleon and Islam it was translated by a Scottish monetary reformer called James Gibbs Stuart, who has written many books, The Money Bomb, Hidden Menace, etc. And he translated this book from French into English, which we published in Malaysia at the time when we were helping Mahathir and the Malaysians to fend off the IMF. So this is an important book. I did the new foreword to this.
Mm-hmm.
Propaganda in the Next War, again, a reissued book with a new foreword by myself,
okay,
which was published in 1938, in which the British plan was to get Japan to attack America. So from the American standpoint, it's very important we know this information.
It's interesting that you bring up both of those events, because as you did mention, the winners always write the history books, and sadly for the world, these people have come out on top more often than not, and one of the ways that they've been able to do that is by the control of the financial systems of the world. And even when they lose a particular battle, they're able to come out on top because, by and large, they have so many strings and control of all the different finances of the world.
Precisely.
That they end up the winner anyway.
Yes, I think historically this is the case, that unless you understand money, its creation and its control, then you can't make any sense of history. And I'm reminded of, the great statements by Jefferson, Madison, particularly Madison, who he makes a marvelous observation on this point. He said, history records that the money changers have used every form of abuse, intrigue, deceit, and violent means possible to maintain their control over governments by controlling money and its issuance.
Well, so I want to add something to that, because you know Alexander Hamilton was seemingly working for the Rothschilds.
Yes.
in his promotion of the central banking system and the rest of it. And of course, you know that Madison and he never saw eye to eye, nor did Jefferson with him.
But of course.
One of the interesting things is, though, that they both, all three of these men were Masons.
Yes, well, there are good Masons and bad Masons, and I think the important thing is that it's not to tar them all with the same brush. Most people join the Masonic for very laudable reasons, that they believe it's an extension of the Boy Scouts, and it's most of them have no knowledge of what its real intention is. So, yes, Jefferson was a Mason, and so were many others, but when you read whoever fought the banks could not possibly have been working for the Masonic fraternity.
That's
and
right.
Clearly Jefferson and Madison and the others were definitely against the system of interest-based finance.
Well, let's start with the Bank of England and the control that has been exerted on that bank over time. And in fact, it was one of the seed causes of the Revolutionary War. I mean, there were other reasons, but this one was the principal one. So let's talk about the for a few minutes here.
Well, look, we've all had glorious revolutions. Most, if not all of them, have been financed by the bankers or the purveyors of debt-based finance, and the English Revolution was no different. And very close to where I live in Chesterfield is the Revolution House, and there met the three of the major noble families who were all bankers and plotted our revolution. So remember that the bankers are always behind conflict, and biblically, of course, you may or may not subscribe to the biblical account of Korah, the cousin of Moses, but he was the main fomenter of trouble between the Israelites. But the English Revolution brought to power, and I finished now 60 years of research papers on this subject now, which I'm publishing as The Other Road to Serfdom, that Lord Clarendon points out, since Cromwell came to power, we have been surrounded by a tribe of bankers. So, the bankers were the ones who fomented the trouble, and we were Amsterdam. The Bank of England was set up in 1694, and the debt of 1.2 million levied on the British people till the day of judgment at 8%. Now, that 1.2 million was to set up the Private Bank of England.
Right.
And that debt now has compounded to, say, some 400,000 million in terms of interest. And we pay 36,000 million in interest this year on that original debt. So that sets the scene for all conflict in Europe and, of course, the War of Independence from America against the Bank of England.
Well, because in each case, as the British Crown grew in its tentacles, they need to keep servicing the debt that they've created through these banking structures. And in fact, the only way they can continue to do that through this fractional reserve that was even in place and back in those days, not the same kind of fractional reserve that we have today, but certainly the same concept. And now, so basically, the Crown had to keep demanding more and more from its satellite nations, and of course that was an untenable situation both for countries such as India and as well as America.
Yes, well it's an interesting point. My mother's family were with the East India Company in 1840, who went to India, and her maiden name is Campbell Thomas. So the Campbell Regiment also went in 1857 to put down the Indian Mutiny, and all these mutinies were about the English bankers preventing trade developing between anybody other than those who were to pay the levy to the City of London. Because you mentioned earlier the Crown. The Crown is totally powerless, and also the elected Prime Ministers of England for the past 300 years, all of them have to be invited to enter the City of London, which is Satan's citadel, to coin a common phrase in England. So the Crown is there purely as a figurehead. Since 1694, the Crown has been powerless.
It is, and they basically sprinkle small favors on the Crown to keep it as a happy little element in their control mechanism. Basically.
Yes, exactly. They're the figurehead, and as my cousin pointed out, the Jewish one. She says that, well, it's your queen, but it's our country. So the point is that the queen or the battle between the City of London and the rest of the country for the past three to 400 years is clear by the fact when the queen, she has to stop at Temple Bar, and the Prime Minister cannot enter the City of London without invitation. Of course, it's now sort of a ritual, but basically that sets the scene that the Lord Mayor of London is more powerful than the Prime Minister or the monarch.
Well, so now what we've got happening in the colonies was that because of their wars and forays that were being instigated, and by the way, I'd like to mention, and maybe you'll agree with this, oftentimes, even though they've been making money on their usury, when they foment a conflict in a far-off land or even in Europe, they made sure they found mechanisms within the government of the time to pay for those forays. They didn't go dipping often into their treasury. They would get it right from the public, wouldn't they?
Yes, indeed. The point is very interesting. I've been observing now the situation with Jefferson, who seemed to be the most articulate and the clearest thinker of most of the president, but all of them were incredibly well educated on this subject. But Jefferson points out that he said the modern theory for the perpetuation of debt has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulating. This was around about 1813, and I have all of his correspondence, which I've been studying. And so he understood, and of course the idea was to control the world, because the City of London would not take goods, cotton, they wanted money. And therefore, the whole thing was people like my mother's family and others' families went out to steal the world for the City of London. That was they went for booty, not for duty.
Well, here's the other side of it, too. At the time of Jefferson's education, when he was learning Montesquieu and many others back
yes.
in 1785 and 1780, France had not fallen to these bankers quite yet. And, in fact, the King of France was still one of the holdouts against them. Although he had borrowed from them, he had not turned over his crown to them. And so maybe part of the pressure that was being placed on the French king was made available, that information was made available to Jefferson during his ambassadorship to France. And so when he watched the French crown be taken apart, he must have been well aware that it was the London bankers that were pushing forward this whole,
yes.
The financing of the Jacobins and the whole bit.
Yes, yes.
And so he probably returned to America and said, we can't allow this to happen in our own country.
Indeed, I think this is, he was clearly an amazing observer of things, and from his writings and what other, but it's not only him. It seems to me that they were all well versed in the situation. But of course, the Rothschilds were smuggling gold through France for the Peninsular Wars,
right.
And this was for a little later. But they were also funding, as they always have done. The bankers always fund both sides because one side will lose and of course be under your control, and the winners will also give you very good situations and conditions in which you can function. These are called usurer-friendly systems. But Napoleon, it's interesting, was the wild card. He did everything that was not expected of him. And when he sees the debt of France, which is quite remarkable, he said, "The deadly facts herein reveal that it is amazing that this monster interest has not devoured all humanity. It would have done so long ago had not bankruptcy and revolution acted as counterpoisons." So the terrorism or the wars and the conflict always come from escalating debt and the compounding element of interest. This is historically, for the past 5,000 years, at least traceable.
Now, what we've got in America and in the 1780s through the 1830s, is a battle going on between the Hamilton camp of federalism and central control,
yeah.
and then acquiescing to the bankers, and people like Jefferson who won out along with Madison. And so what we've got here is that at least in the dawning stages of America's history, we had our liberty. We had the Constitution. That was a remarkable piece of work. And we had the freedom of our own continental script that was not
yes.
being usurized by these people. So what happened and what were these people's plans? Because I know they tried U.S. script coming from Rothschild several times.
Yeah.
before they were able in 1913 to finally get control. How did they get this stuff underway?
Well, the thing was, it's interesting, when Franklin came to London, he was asked why the conditions in the colonies were far superior to those for people living in the mother country. And he said, it is because we issue our own colonial script, and we were quite happy to withstand the meager tax on tea, but it was English bankers preventing us issuing our colonial script that caused the War of Independence. And he's saying that they ensured, as a government, that if there was $1 million worth of wealth to consume, they ensured that there was $1 million in cash or currency or credit to consume what people have produced, because there's no point in producing if people are not going to consume. So that was Franklin's explanation of the War of Independence. It was down to English bankers, and not only that, the enemy for the British people were the English bankers, because a little later on there we find Gladstone, one of the great liberal prime ministers, saying that about the Bank of England, that it, from becoming the banker's bank, it had become the government's government. And so he was prevented as head of the Treasury or Prime Minister, and had no money in six figures until they set up the Post Office Savings Bank. So they were in office, but they were not in power.
So what we've got here, and I remember clearly the actual instigation of several conflicts, including the War of 1812, was a real difficult period for Americans, because they burned our capital to the ground.
Yes.
But it was really instigated by Rothschild money and by the bankers' money.
Yes.
In order to try another hand at taking America's banking system, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. And I think it's what's intriguing is that Wilson, of course, that Wilson was elected on the basis that that he saved us from the war, but immediately he went and got into power. America entered the war once the Balfour Declaration had been signed, and Baruch and everybody, all the machinations of those people got into play. But what he admits after he signed the Federal Reserve Act, he said, "I'm a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country." So this is the president who gives Trotsky his American passport and sends the first Bolshevik government from New York to govern Russia, and he's admitting that he has destroyed America's democracy. He said, "I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated." And he goes on to say, "The growth of the nation, therefore, and all our activities in the hands of a few men. Now this is the point. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world. No longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by the conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men." And now
can I ask you who those dominant men were and are?
Yes. Well, it's the same families, and this is something that, of course, usury is forbidden to the children of Israel. Those who practice usury, interest, lend money, they are completely abandoned every tenet and of Judaism as it is in its modern form, or let's say the Torah and the Ten Commandments. These are apostates from the faith. So, but they use the agenda and the cohesive nature of the Jewish communities, and so you have Warburg. And now it's interesting, Abby Warburg remained in Germany during the entire period of the Second World War, so because he was a financier of Hitler. So there are those people who have been very much in control from historically, but also from the period of the time of the Bible. It's the same group of people,
and they're carrying this fortune forward. Are the hands that control the fortune the same, or are they reinventing the names as generations pass? Because as you and I both know, the profile that the Rothschilds have taken in banking have also opened themselves up to a great deal of criticism. And it seems to me that the real people who control those fortunes aren't even the people whose name is on the banner out front of the building.
I think that they are very much in control. And I think that the fact that they are, most of them are private corporations, even the Rockefellers, because they are from the Sephardic elite. I mean, they claim to be Christians, but in actual fact, they're claimed, Nelson Rockefeller and others, people like that, they are part of the Sephardic Jewish elite. And therefore, historically, you'll find now, say, Jacob Schiff, Karenina Schiff is married to Al Gore's son, a daughter rather. So the family, it is a dynasty that continues from generation to generation historically, and the biblical account and the Quranic account point out that this group are against the Torah and against God's commandments, but they derive enormous power through the creation and control of money.
Well, what you've just pointed out is something important, because we've done some work on what we call and what the Encyclopedia Judaica calls crypto-Judaism, and you just pointed out that the Rockefellers and others have been, where they were not able to be upfront about their Jewish roots, they used subterfuge, and they used actual fraud to set themselves up as Christians, wolves in sheep's clothing here.
And so
we look at the Muranos. We did a study on this on the French Connection. We also look at the Dolmets in Turkey.
Yes.
And we've looked at throughout history where even including some of the leadership of the Nazi Party being Jewish, and including the Jews in charge of communism in Russia.
Oh yes.
So we've got crypto Judaism across the time and history of these people. And do we have it in large measure in America today?
Indeed. Well, look, what's also interesting is I have been following this particular line of inquiry. I have a copy of the Jewish Chronicle in front of me. Now, the Jewish Chronicle is one of the most eminent and respected journals. And December the 6th, 1996, there's a headline, Who Were Hitler's Jewish Soldiers? There were about 169 senior officers who were either entirely Jewish or half-Jewish, including the head of the Luftwaffe, Field Marshal Erhard Milch, was Jewish. Now, including Wilberg, the designer of Blitzkrieg, and there's a whole bunch of them in the Daily Telegraph, again, another respected universe. Basically, the fatherland's honor. You have Helmut Wilberg, the architect in the concept of Blitzkrieg, Edgar Jacobson, and also Helmut Schmidt, who became the head of the government in Germany after World War II. So Helmut Schmidt was half Jewish. So but these are the people who didn't do anything to try and liberate the people from the concentration camps. They were part of the system.
Well, the goal, according to both Myron Fagan's work as well as more importantly Benjamin Friedman, being a first person account, was to get an exodus of Jews to repopulate the Holy Land so that they could get their 6 million number. And of course, we could talk at another show about them wanting to bring in their new Messiah.
Before you go on from that, it's a very, very important point.
Uh-huh.
The important thing is that the ones who were in the concentration camp, and there was a Holocaust, there's no doubt about that. Periodically through history, you find this has happened. But if you read the Torah or the Bible, you see that God sent them to be an excoriation and a hissing and a booing to the lands that he'd sent them, and they were not to return to Palestine until the Messiah came. But the ones who were exterminated, and whether the figure is 1.4 million or 6 million, the point was that they were the ones who wanted to uphold the traditions of the Torah and wanted basically to re-implement the Sharia of Moses, which Muslims would have accepted. But it's a secular belonging of Israel today, and the ones who were exterminated were the ones who were believers in God, basically.
So true Torah Jews were selected out.
Yes, that's right. They didn't want people with consciences like the Natura Carta, who, of course, are very brave people. They are critical and openly oppose the State of Israel because it is contrary to what God ordered them to do.
Well, I've been working with Rabbi Weiss over in New York.
Excellent people. Excellent.
Yes, they are. Well, here's the next question. So we get back to America's trying to battle back against these people. And, of course, now we move past forward from the 1812 conflict and several other attempts to try to pass in Congress U.S. script, which is really a veiled type of usury money from these people from the Rothschild camp.
Yeah.
We have the same problem with in Lincoln's time, and what happened, I think, in Lincoln's time was the South was being by and large financed by Rothschild money to keep this war. In fact, Jefferson Davis's finance minister was a Rothschild plant.
Appointee, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Indeed. Well, I think that these are the points that when Lincoln went to New York to try and raise money for continuing the war, they were going to charge him. I think it was 37% interest. So he went back to Washington, and I understand that he said, "We have two great enemies: the Southern Army at our front, and the financial institutions at our rear. And the greatest enemy is the one behind us." So that's when he issues his greenback dollar.
Yep.
So the greenback dollar was based on the design for that David Ricardo did for the National Bank of England. We never got the National Bank of England. We still have the Private Bank of England. But Lincoln was smart because he understood that money is a creature of law. And if you read his 1865 Declaration, it's probably the most eloquent description that there's ever been written on money, apart from Imam Ghazali, the great Islamic scholar in the 11th century. Both of them understood that the key, the power, is in money. And Lincoln, of course, he was shot 3 days later after he'd actually said that money should become once again servant, not master.
Well, and of course, John Wilkes Booth was a
Rothschild a relative, I understand. It's the theory of relatives, by the way, not the conspiracy theory. It's the theory of relatives.
Theory of relativity.
Yes, the theory of relativity. Yes.
Well, so now we've seen actually several examples of how America has been assaulted by these people.
Yeah.
They finally, what they did was, now, in toward the 1880s and 90s, when they made their next attempt to set these things up, what they did in advance of that this time was send America into a terrible depression. It was the depression that preceded the 1930s depression.
Yeah.
And in fact, it lasted for like 10 or 11 years of serious hardship in America in the 1880s and 90s. And then what came was that the robber barons began to rise up under the power of Rothschild money.
Yes, yes.
And it was they who came in and tried to exert their influence on setting up this next banking structure under Pierpont Morgan,
yes,
who originally, as what I understand, was not on board with these people, but subsequently became a follower and did turn his power over to Rothschild.
Indeed.
So what we've got now is, they changed their strategy. They imploded the country. They got people over to buy stuff cheap. They set themselves up as robber barons, including the Rockefeller fortune was begun at that period.
Yes.
And then they made their next attempt, which was successful this time. And you want to go to pick up the story from there?
Yeah. Well, the what happens then, of course, is related to, you remember the situation with the family, the guy who flew the Atlantic, the first man.
Lindbergh.
Lindbergh, yes. Now, his father, who was very much against the setting up of the Federal Reserve, I think it was the Ames Bill that it was called at that point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, the kidnapping of his granddaughter, I think it was, or was part of it to actually silence his opposition. And of course, the whole it couldn't have been controlled until you had the Federal Reserve in place. So the point being that the Fed was the means, the mechanism by which the whole world could be controlled in conjunction with the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve, and that was the whole basis of getting it into place. But if I could just quote what the warning that Jefferson makes about setting up a Federal Reserve. He says that if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the thing you're talking about, this, the ability to deflate the economy, the banks will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continents their fathers conquered. The issuing power of money should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belonged. So Jefferson, all of them understood, and Jackson, who they tried to kill twice. You remember Jackson?
Yes.
I think the gun failed to fire on both occasions.
Yes.
Jackson said, if Congress has the right under the Constitution to issue paper money, it was given them to use themselves, not to be delegated to individuals or corporations. And of course, this is exactly what happened, and why Wilson, of course, who was compromised in his affair with his neighbor, and basically they forced things through, and Wilson was required to be either be exposed as an adulterer or to sign the bill.
And there were other people, other places. Andrew Johnson, just after the assassination of Lincoln,
yes,
he tried to get rid of the War Powers Act and the Executive Powers
yes,
Act. So that,
yes.
And this was actually, he was actually, at, they tried to impeach him with Rothschild money.
Yes.
Because what he was trying to do was to return the sovereignty of the government back to the people.
Indeed.
And he was actually successful, and then he was reversed later on, was he
yes.
not?
Yes, indeed. Well, this is historically, this has been going on for at least 5,000 years. You can see the whole, this history that I'm finishing now, you can
yep.
go from 2400 BC right up to the present day and find exactly the same problem facing every society, and if we haven't learnt anything from history, because as I say, the history was written by the victors or those who wish to continue with their nefarious activities. And of course Kennedy paid the price 5 months after he'd signed his executive order 11110, and this was more or less to bring back the concept of the Treasury issuing greenback money, or money that was free of interest and free of debt.
Right.
So this point is that Kennedy was also a bit of a wild card, because when he was in London with his father, when his father was ambassador, Kennedy attended lectures and was tutored by the LSE, or people in the LSE, London School of Economics, and of course he understood that the power was in the money, and he could have prevented the Vietnam War, the escalation, by just spending into circulation the money that was required to support the deficit that had been created through debt. So Kennedy, unfortunately, was got rid of, and I'm sure that this was the real agenda for his the loss of
well,
life.
There was
Lincoln.
Actually more than one reason that they gave for him to be gotten rid of. He was also starting to speak out quite vociferously against Israel, beginning their
yes.
Attempt to get the bomb as well.
Yes.
And what he did was he saw a clear danger of not only the banking structure, but these people starting to take real power in the world by building bombs as well. And
yes.
Michael Collins Piper does a very good job of bringing those facts forward as well in his recent work.
Yes.
So I understand that and he also had some other reasons that there was the Levant affair that had just
yes.
happened just before his election that he was aware of as well and was you know, quite well circulated. And so he saw the treachery.
Yes, indeed. If you mentioned something a little earlier about J.P. Morgan. Now we're jumping around a little bit, but I think we're entitled to be in this stage just to J.P. Morgan, and we come to we had World War One, and what's interesting that there's a very famous economist called Silvio Gesell. And he predicted, you're on the continent, but not too far away from where he was, but he wrote an article in the German newspaper Zeitung am Mittag, a German language newspaper. When they were signing the armistice in 1918, he predicted World War II would occur within less than 25 years, and he said, exactly, and within the time frame, he was proven to be correct. What's interesting about J.P. Morgan and the links between the Bush family, I have here an article that shows that the main financiers of Hitler was Prescott Bush, and George Bush's other grandfather, you know, the Herbert Walker,
and also the Harriman fortune.
The Harrimans, yeah, Bernie Harriman and Avril Harriman, etc. And these were, of course, the main people behind the Bush, behind the Hitler project. Now, the intriguing thing is that with the power of the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, because the Bank of England, the governor of the Bank of England from the 20s, early 20s onward, the longest serving governor was Montague Norman. Now, he put his back on the gold standard in 1928, and Winston Churchill was going to hang him for treason for putting it on the gold standard. And then later, of course, Hilmar Schacht went from New York from the J.P. Morgan Bank to become Hitler's banker, and he understood, of course, how to solve the problem of inflation, because the banks create inflation. So this is a link between America and the Hitler project, and the Bush family being the main two of the main finances of that project.
So George Bush's patron saint is Adolf Hitler and his crew.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah.
I'm afraid so. And the article I have from the in the Guardian, I did a piece, three articles for the Gulf Today, and it was entitled "When Bush Comes to Shove," and that was published in there. But the Guardian, then, in the British Guardian, which is a most respected newspaper, then published exactly the article "How Bush's Grandfathers Helped Hitler's Rise to Power," and that is the Guardian, which is one of the most prestigious papers. And there's a picture of Prescott Bush, who a friend of mine, I have three Jewish friends who converted to Islam, by the way, and one of them said, "Yes, we know of the Ashkenazim links between the Bush family, so what you were telling me earlier is very intriguing about the Bush connection. I'm very,
well,
very
Solomon,
interested."
There was an actual George Bush that was Jewish that came over with the New Bohemians.
Right.
There was also another Solomon Bush. Now, Solomon Bush particularly is interesting because he came over with a pocket full of cash to set up one of four Masonic lodges at the behest of Weishaupt. And, of course, Weishaupt was set up the umbrella organization of the Illuminati.
Yes, of course.
Which basically is just a camp for tricking wealthy Jewish financiers into this conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the conspiracy, of course, when you start looking at it, not all the Jewish community under this Sabbatian movement was part of this stuff. And what they did was they were very brilliant. They always set up conflicting organizations that they controlled at both sides of.
Yes, exactly.
So that if you thought you were fighting Sabbatianism as a Jew, you were actually in a camp that was working with them. And it's just astonishing.
Well, I think if you go back to the famous the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, the great American, he was the head of both the Scottish Rite and the new southern jurisdiction of Masonry, Albert Pike.
That's right.
Now, Albert Pike, of course, he was the head of both conflicting groups, and this is precisely what you've just said is correct. You manipulate both because neither of them know, but there is one controlling element, and this is genius at work.
No, it is genius, but it's genius in its simplicity.
Yes.
What it all hinges upon is the selling of this to the masses. And of course, you know that they if you read anything to do with what they talked about in the Zohar and in different parts of their writings, and including the protocols, which they call a forgery, which anybody out there who wonders what a forgery is, it's a copy of the original.
Yes.
Now,
well, yes, certainly. And in my book, Satanic Voices, Ancient and Modern, which is one that I compiled, I touch upon this on these very points you're making.
Well, here's the interesting thing that comes out of this: that they set this situation up to destroy all of the ability of the public to make an informed decision. Now, would they do that through control of the media? Now, they also do it through control of fashion. Now, fashion, interestingly enough, I don't just mean clothing fashion. I mean fashion of the day.
Yeah.
I mean conventional wisdom that is in the society, and they do this through a very careful molding of people's opinions and people's mindset, which is what they've done exactly with the ability, for them to stop any discussion about Jewish issues and tagging somebody with anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Most Americans, when they hear the word Jew, just the word,
they cringe.
That's right, because they've tied the word together with a fear of being a racist.
Yes.
And so we've stopped all debate by the fashion of the day.
Yes. And you're absolutely right.
And of course, now we're in a situation, David, where we're not even able to discuss in any rational forum how these people are killing us.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. Well, but this, of course, is you quote the protocols, and just listen, by seeing we've seen the Last Temptation and the latest thing with the cartoons, but this is also part of the protocols, and the protocols are only really a revised version of the Talmud via Herzl's own. Herzl had a copy of the protocols with him in Baal. And Rabbi Aaron Priest pointed that out. So the Judenstadt and the Jewish state, this is all based on something that is well understood. But just to quote here from the protocol, he said, "By our mockeries and our attacks upon them, we shall make their priests ridiculous and odious, and then their religion as ridiculous and as odious as their clergy."
Look what they did with this recent pope, making him hang on to look like a dribbling idiot, and most of his presentations, that was done by design. In the history of Catholicism over the millennia, when a pope became enfeebled by his own physical incapacities, he was either marginalized or eliminated because they wanted a strong face of the church.
Yes.
What we know now is that even the church has been subverted, and that this gentleman, too, has a mother who was Jewish, and that he was really a figurehead to really denigrate the cohesion within any Catholic faith.
That's interesting. I'd heard that, but I didn't. I haven't seen any of the supporting evidence. But by their fruits you will know them, as the Bible says of the New Testament.
Well, we do know them, and here's the interesting thing: the financial arm is not the only arm that exerts itself here.
No,
they have a spiritual arm of this organization, and it also has used subterfuge to ensnare the Jewish community. It is today the group called the Shabbat Lubavitch, who has taken the lead role, and as Mohammed Rafik pointed out so clearly, they were actually set up in their origins as an alternative to Sabbateanism, and what they did was they actually set up another type of Judaism to compete with themselves, so that ultimately now, when they're bringing out the real plan, the Lubavitchers, who've been with them for many, many generations, are actually being caught up in this conspiracy along with the rest.
Yes, everybody's serving a purpose. The agenda is certainly not divine. It's satanic, I'm afraid, in the sense that this is... very, very, I mean, the end justifying the means shows you the spirit which is driving the whole thing. From my standpoint, I came from a Roman Catholic background. As I mentioned, my sister converted to Judaism and my cousin, so we do have a long weekend. But you can live with the differences once you understand the game plan. The other important bit that's important is also to look at the alteration not only of history but of geography. I've spent the past 30 years actually following up a lot of the material, but now we can, with certainty, it's clear that Mount Sinai and is in Saudi Arabia, not in Egypt, and then why the Bible is altered, or that Mount Sinai is altered, yet it's Paul who gives away the fact that things have been altered when he says this in Galatians 4, that this Hagar, the mother of Ishmael, is Mount Sinai in Arabia. So then we start to look And then we find that the prophecies and things that actually we refer to can only be interpreted, understood, once you put the children of Israel in Arabia, as it is now, or Midian, as it was then. So that even in that area, that we've had a tremendous alteration and a manipulation of
evidence.
Well,
what happens here, and this is the duality of these people, and what you pointed out, with the suspension of ethics, the teleological suspension of ethical principles,
yes,
meaning the ends justifying the means. When you,
yes,
take a look at this, Muhammad also did a very good description of what that means. He said, in their mind, God is a duality. His left,
yes,
hand does the evil, his right hand does
the
good.
Yes.
And so that they never have a conflict with making evil events transpire on our world, especially against the cattle like Goyim.
The Goyim cattle,
and,
yes.
And so the situation is that they're really not having to suspend ethics in their mind, because
the end does justify the means.
Well, it does, but
yes,
not only that, David, even more than that, they believe it's God's work,
yes,
because God's left hand is the evil side, but it's still God himself in their
indeed
mind.
Indeed. In fact, you may, and I'm sure that if you haven't, that it is really worth reading, is Israel Shahak's book, Jewish History, Jewish Religion, the Weight of 3,000 Years. And he was a survivor of the Holocaust, I think, from Belsen. And he was living in Israel as a professor of organic chemistry. And his book is brilliant in showing that this amazing situation where you have a cohort in the synagogue. Now, he's saying that 9 out of 10 are probably worshipping Satan because they fear him more than they do God. But so long as you do everything the same, there is no conflict. But it's when you do something different in terms of your action where you end up in serious trouble. So this is also an astonishing thing. Most people believe, and most Muslims and most Christians believe that, well, let's say, modern, or what we would call traditional Judaism, actually has this belief and the belief of bringing about the sexual union between God and his Shekinah, his wife, in the morning prayer. This is completely astonishing to Christians and Muslims. I've spoken to Muslims and they don't believe me until I show them the book. So we have this astonishing ability to run with the hare and bite with the hounds and see nothing incongruous about it.
Well, that's right, and that comes basically from this Lurian-based group that was actually setting up Sabbatai Zevi's thought process.
Yes.
You have to see that they've adopted over time the usury portions of their plan to enslave us all, and it,
yes,
seems like we've got two groups, as I alluded to earlier. The one group being their spiritual side, and the other group being their financial, and they're seemingly on the same page for most of it, but there has to be conflicts within these people's machinations, because it seems like certain elements within France are not entirely on board with these people. And I don't know if that's just a diversion or there are real differences in some ways between what's happening out of London and what's happening out of New York.
Yeah, well, there may be, there's a point that if you I've studied this thing with the magic and other things, with even with Aleister Crowley, and studying that, because you find these links all the way back to this left hand concept.
Mm-hmm.
But Crowley said that there is no argument between the battle between Grand Lodge of London, of England, and the Vatican has never been over content. It has been over jurisdiction. So it's a matter of who wants to be the number one. And so the battle is not over content. It's over who is going to be, the head of the clan or the head of the group.
In every mafia, and this is the
yeah,
the largest mafia the world's ever known, and every mafia, there are competing interests. And of
course,
now there are people out there with 100 billion fortunes that are going up against people with 10 trillion billion.
Yes.
But still, when you get those kinds of monies, you can create havoc. Now, here's the interesting thing. The Malaysians were able, under their latest stop that they placed on participation with the World Bank, back when the Asian crisis hit back,
yes,
in the mid-90s, what we've seen through their movement away from accessing loans, first of all, let me say, country very similar to Malaysia, but probably a larger economy originally, went the route of taking IMF money and taking World Bank money. That was Argentina, and
yes.
You saw the result.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Now, the other country that did not take it, Malaysia, at your urgings and urgings of others, was able, at least, well, they didn't avoid pain, but they avoided the calamity.
Yes. Well, I took the survival plan myself personally to Mahathir, and I delivered it to him at the Langkawi Air Show, and the issue was from a group in the United Kingdom, the Bromsgrove Group, headed by James Gibbs Stuart, who was the one who translated the Napoleon and his time from French into English, and the plan was basically to stop the betting after hours, because the stock market in Singapore, they had an extra hour, so they knew what had come in on the race before after the closure of the bourse in Malaysia, and we gave them all the things which they put into place, and they survived. So IMF in Malaysia stands for Intimidation, Murder and Fraud, or Infant Mortality Fund, but Mahathir and Norbin Yaqub and the others, they actually acted on the advice given by Mohammed Rafiq, was one of them who you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and we all put together the proposal, and they implemented it. So we have got some understanding of how you can survive the IMF, but all it requires is really for somebody with some strength to actually do it. And Mahathir has that; he has the courage to do that.
Well, you know, our hour is almost up here, and I know you've got other plans.
Yes, yes.
But I want to let you know that I mean, I am a student of these facts, and I do my homework, as you can tell. And
yes, indeed.
The people that are listening to this broadcast are also students of these facts as well, and we are all in a situation now where it is a very late hour, David. We need desperately to attract as many people to these facts as possible,
yes.
In order to at least affect a modicum of truth out into this world. We're never going to get there. We're never going to stop them cold. But what we can do is begin a process that educates the masses. And
yes.
I wonder, you know, well, can we do it, Dave? I mean, I
believe we can. Yeah. Yeah, look, you only beat when you admit or you give up. So the point is that the media and the fact that we have a few people, but a few people can make the difference, and it requires. If John Wilkes Booth can make the difference, I mean, we're talking that he did turn the case of history. So one person can make an improvement or can make a severe indentation, but certainly we have to. To continue, and you have such huge, giants of people like Lincoln, Edison. You know, Thomas Edison. I'm just reading something from Edison. It is absurd that our country, can issue $30 billion in bonds, but not $30 million in currency. Both are promises to pay, but one fattens the usurer, and the other helps the people. So we have to use the law. I think the legal process to take governments to court for the non. Performance. Basically, we now have in England a woman who could have treatment for cancer, but they're saying her local government or the health authority hasn't got it in the budget. There can be no limit placed on money. It's only that men create money so they can create enough, or they can create too little, and we have to make sure that they create enough.
Well, we're going to do another subject sometime soon in this series, David, because as you can tell, this is a serious network that you're on right now. You're on the French Connection. We don't mess around with the nonsense. We're going right for the real stuff.
Yes.
And I'm very grateful to have had you on for this hour.
Oh.
And you know, we're in the fight together. The people
yes.
that do listen to this, listen, ladies and gentlemen, support the French Connection. Support David Pidcock by looking through his authorship. And later on, when things actually start unraveling in America, which they will, you'll understand who's doing it and why, and you'll
yes.
be able to share this information with your neighbors.
Yes.
Because this is the real key here, ladies and gentlemen. We've got to get this information out there, and we've got to, you know, people in America are not going to move until they feel the bite of this awful event. But once they do, they're going to be looking for people who did it to them.
Yes.
That will be the time you come forward with your information, and that'll be a perfect timing, ladies and gentlemen. Trust me. David, thank you so much again. I will be in contact with you as you, go forward. We've got other things we're trying to do right now together, so
yes.
I want to thank
you. Well, I'm glad to be part of the team. You know, we're here to serve. That's our duty.
Well, you know, you're more than that. You've been doing it much longer than me. Can I tell you how long I've been doing this, David?
Well, it sounds like a lifetime, but you surprised me.
13 months.
Oh, I'm very surprised. Very
I knew
good.
Nothing. I knew nothing 13 months ago.
Well, I think you did you not serve in Vietnam, or did I?
No. I actually, the mid-1970s, I was injured on a ship.
Uh-huh.
I was serving in the United States Navy, and I was injured, and that
wasn't
happened.
The Liberty, was it?
Well, no, it's actually a ship they sent to the bottom of the ocean called the USS America.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yeah. They sent the ship's namesake, which is the nation's namesake, to the bottom of the ocean.
Wow. Well.
So I think that was symbolic in some way.
Indeed, huh? I do. I think so too.
Anyway,
right.
I know you've got things to go do. I want to thank you again, and ladies and gentlemen, David Pidcock. You look his name up. You'll see all kinds of information on this gentleman, and we'll be talking to you soon, David.
Thank you very much.
A remarkable interview, a remarkable one. The information we meandered through tonight's show was certainly educational, but more important than educational, it was factual to a fault. When you check on the information that we've vetted here, you know, what you're going to find is that everything, without exception, I was going to say sans exception, without exception, has been checked into, has been looked into, has been checked over. It has been written by many, and you will find in his compilation works, as well as many others, that the things we talked about tonight are all facts. And we've got more facts to share with you on the French Connection. You need to go out and recruit people. You need to. It is not an option. I won't fight for nobody. I've got to fight for people. I know my subject, I know my world, I know the things that we're doing, and I know the people to get it done with, but I need you. This is not a one-man operation, it never has been. I rely on every single one of you people out there to make this thing work. Do your part, bring the people, one person a week. Use the Socratic method, ladies and gentlemen. What is that? Pose questions to people. Ask them, well, why is it that this is happening? You know, I read this. Want to take a look at it and tell me what you think? And when you find somebody sympathetic to what you've showed them, you show them something else. And then you show them the French Connection. These are the ways to recruit. Don't go head-to-head with people in arguments. That's a waste of your time. If it's your brother and he doesn't want to believe you, I've had this happen. If it's your friend or your colleague that doesn't want to go down this road, pass over them immediately. Spend not a second breath on them. Maybe sometime in the future they'll come to the truth. Go after people who are ready to hear these facts and bring them to the French Connection. This is not fun radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is a movement across our world that's going to take it all back. And it's starting now. It's up to you. For the French Connection, this is Daryl Bradford Smith signing out for the evening. Bye-bye now.